as a waste of food. Second, you will learn Skaldic. He moved in protest, chains sounding. I held up my hand. If you would be my companion, I said ruthlessly, you will serve your lord and win his trust, and make of yourself a gift fit for princes. Because if you do not, Gunter will give me to Voldemar Selig anyway, and kill you for sport. I swear to you, Jocelyn, if you will do this much for me and live, I will make my escape with you, and cross the snows without one word of trepidation. Will you obey? He bowed his head, matted blonde hair hiding his proud d'Angeline features.
Yes, he whispered.
Good, I said, and turned to my escort. He comes to understand his position, I said in Skaldic. He consents to receive the gift of tongues. I will teach him that he may comprehend and obey my lord Gunter Arnlaugsson. Do you say it is fairly done?
They glanced at each other and shrugged.
He stays among the hounds until he has proved his worth, Knut called.
I nodded my assent. Listen well, I said to Jocelyn, who attended my words with a faint light of hope in his eyes. This is the word for I. So began my third role among the Skaldi, although they themselves may only have counted two. Consort, bard, and teacher. To his credit, Jocelyn learned quickly. It is harder to learn as an adult than as a child, but if he had lost the ease that childhood affords, he made up for it in stubborn persistence. By virtue of having accompanied me on that first outing, Harold and Knut had appointed themselves my permanent escort, and it amused them to watch our lessons. Jocelyn, I learned, they regarded as a genuine barbarian, wild and untamed, hitherto lacking even rudimentary speech. I could not, in truth, entirely blame them for this. If I had seen no more of the Castelline than they had, I too might have thought him a savage. It is a fine line in all of us between civilization and savagery. To any who think they would never cross it, I can only say, if you have never known what it is to be utterly betrayed and abandoned, you cannot know how close it is. Gunter turned an indulgent eye to the proceedings. He had paid good coin for a d'Angeline warrior prince, and if I thought I could transform the snarling captive he'd gotten instead into something worthy of serving a Skaldi tribal lord, he was willing to let me try. Through the kindness of Hatevik and the other women of the steading, I was able to smuggle a few bits of comfort to Jocelyn. A woolen jerkin from one, worn but still serviceable. Rags to wrap his hands and his feet inside his boots, even a poorly cured bearskin, which stank, but afforded considerable warmth. Unfortunately, the dogs tore it to shreds, and Jocelyn was badly bitten on his left arm when he sought to rescue it, but Knut, swearing me to silence, gave me a bit of salve to put on the wounds. He said he'd gotten it from a village witch who'd put the virtue of healing in it. Whether or not it was true, it smelled much like any other ointment I'd known. Jocelyn's arm healed without festering. I think it pleased Gunter to wait to evaluate Jocelyn's progress. I was hard-pressed to track the days passing, but I think it was nigh on to 2 weeks before he put Jocelyn's learning to the test. In all the time before that, he paid heed to him only once, visiting the kennels to greet his favourite dogs, tossing them scraps of dried meat to fight over. But for the glint in his eye, it might have been no more than robust Skaldic humour that made him toss one to Jocelyn. I was not there, but I heard about it later. Jocelyn caught the scrap neatly in mid-air and gave his castelline bow, forearms crossed. After that, I gauged him ready enough to meet Gunter as a d'Angeline, and not the feral creature I'd seen him. We rehearsed a greeting, to smooth over his rudimentary Skaldic, and continued to work on the rest. When Gunter chose to acknowledge him, Jocelyn was prepared. It was a dim afternoon, on a day that had threatened snow, and Gunter and his thanes had idled in the hall, drinking for some hours, when he took it in his head to visit Jocelyn. He took me with him, wrapped in fur, and with a few of his men went out to the kennels. They sang and jested and passed a skin of mead. When they reached the kennel, Gunter put his arm around me and shouted for the d'Angeline. Amid a swirl of bounding dogs, Jocelyn emerged. He caught himself briefly at the sight of me under Gunter's arm,
but kept his features expressionless, standing and giving his bow.
"So, Dangeline, what have you learned, eh? Has my little dove taught you to speak like a proper man?"
Gunther asked, squeezing my shoulders.
"I am at my lord's service," Jocelyn said in carefully accented scaldic, bowing again and standing at Castlene ease, hands where the hilts of his daggers would have been.
"Aha, so the wolf cub does more than growl,"
Gunther laughed, and his thanes laughed with him.
"What will you do if I set you loose from the kennels, Dangeline?"
I had given him a bit of thong to tie back his matted locks. Somehow, in rags and squalor, Jocelyn managed to look every inch a Castlene brother.
"I will do as my lord commands," he said, bowing again.
"Will you?"
Gunther looked skeptical.
"Well, there is water to be drawn and wood to be fetched, and Hatefic has been complaining about the house calls, so mayhap we have a use for you, wolf cub. But how do I know you will keep your word, How do I know you'll not try to flee, nor assault us in our sleep, if I give you half a chance? I've not meant to waste setting a guard on you all day."
It was too much scaldic too fast. I saw Jocelyn blink in consternation. "He wants your word that you'll not try to escape nor attack the steading," I said in Dangeline. Jocelyn thought.
"Tell him this," he said to me. "While he keeps you safe, I will protect and serve this steading, as if it were my own. I will do aught he asks, save turn on my own people, unless they be Deglamore's men. This I swear upon my oath."
I repeated his words to Gunther in Scaldic, slowly, so that Jocelyn could follow the gist of it and nod agreement. Gunther scratched his chin.
"He has a mighty hatred for Kilbahar," he said thoughtfully. "So much I fear he may choose vengeance over honour, no matter how he swears. What do you say, little dove? Will the wolf cub honour his oath?"
"My lord," I said honestly, "he is more bound by this oath than words can compass. Mountains will fall and cattle will fly before he breaks it."
"Well then," Gunther grinned at Jocelyn, "it seems my dove has tamed the wolf where all my dogs have failed. I will give you one night to say farewell to your new friends, and in the morning we will see what kind of servant you make."
The Castlene followed the sense of his words, if not the exact meaning. He bowed again, then sat cross-legged in the snow, ignoring the dogs that milled around, sniffing him.
"I will wait my lord's command," he said in Scaldic.
"Is he going to sit there all night?"
Gunther asked me curiously. "I don't know." I'd had my fill of stubborn Castlene honour, and despaired of understanding the logic that drove it. "He might." Gunther roared with laughter.
"What a man! Some prize I will have to show at the old thing, if he will serve. The wolf and the dove, yoked in tandem at Gunther Arnlock's and steading. Even Voldemar Selig might envy such a prize."
In high good spirits he urged his thanes back to the hall, singing loudly about the honour he would win. I glanced back once. Sure enough, Jocelyn sat without moving, watching us go. Chapter 43. Boisterous and crude he might be, but Gunther was a man of his word, and he had Jocelyn's chain struck the following morning. Knut, who harboured a fondness for me, took me to see it. I'd no doubt that Jocelyn would keep his own word, but still freedom was a heady thing to one who'd been kept in chains. He started briefly when the manacle about his neck was unlocked, muscles quivering with the urge to strike out. But Castlene discipline prevailed quickly, and he regained his composure, bowing obediently.
"Well, we will see, eh?"
Gunther said. He jerked his thumb at one of his thanes.
"Turville, you will stay with him today, and keep a watch. Let him do a carl's work. Only give him no weapons, eh? If he need break ice on the stream to fetch water, let him use his hands. Mayhap, when he's proved himself, we'll let him chop wood or somewhat."
"Aye, Gunther." Turville fingered the hatchet in his own belt and grinned, showing a gap in his teeth, knocked out in a friendly contest of strength. "I'll keep an eye on him, never fear."
From what I could see that day, Jocelyn gave him no cause for concern. Indeed, he worked with a will, hauling buckets of water tirelessly from the stream to refill the cisterns of the great hall. No small task. Turville sauntered behind him, whistling and cleaning his fingernails with the point of his dagger. And the women of Gunter's Steading stared. None of them had seen Jocelyn, save for a brief glimpse that first night, when he'd been brought in at the end of a line, half wild and snow-covered. They got a good look at him now. Filthy and dishevelled, smelling of the kennels, Jocelyn was still, undeniably, a d'Angeline.
"He must be a prince in your land," Hatefick whispered to me, awed, watching him emerge from the kitchen with his buckets empty. "Surely all the men do not look so."
"Not all, no," I said wryly, wondering how Gunter would contend with this reaction. One of the younger women, Ailsa, her name was, contrived to brush into Jocelyn, giggling when he blushed and dropped his buckets. Of the two men, I reflected, Jocelyn might have a harder time of it. Gunter and his thanes returned from the hunt, flushed and triumphant, dragging a good-sized hart with them. He was minded to celebrate, and we had a feast that night. Gunter got roaring drunk, not so drunk he didn't have the presence of mind to have Jocelyn chained by the ankle to a great stone bench by the hearth. At least, I thought, both admiring and despising his foresight, it was warm and indoors. Jocelyn curled up in the rushes on the floor, exhausted beyond caring. Even if it hadn't been for his oath, I don't think he would have fled that night if Gunter had left him free with the door standing wide open. As the cold winter days passed and Jocelyn gave no indication of untrustworthiness, matters settled into a routine. One day when Gunter and his thanes were out, Hatefick and I conspired to see Jocelyn bathed. If I had been grateful for my first bath in the Steading, I cannot even begin to fathom how much more so Jocelyn was. We emptied the water twice, so filthy was it. And if I thought my bath had been well attended, it was nothing to his. Women of all ages, from the giggling Ailsa to dour old Romilda, whom I'd never seen smile, crowded into the bathroom to peek at him. The Jocelyn of my earliest acquaintance would have died of mortification. Now he merely blushed and looked politely away, trying to preserve what little dignity they allowed him. Even the most retiring of the women, dark-eyed Turid, came to see, shyly offering a clean woolen jerkin and hose that had belonged to her brother, killed in a raid. He looked dismayed to see his grey castline rags piled for discard, so I gathered them carefully. I understood. It was all he had left of home. "Don't worry," I promised him. "I'll see them washed and mended, if I have to do it myself." I spoke to him in Skaldic, as I tried always to do when others were about. His understanding had improved, and his speech. "I would thank you," he grinned at me, "only I hear talk of your sewing." The women giggled. It was true, Hatefick had been teaching me that I might help with the endless mending, and my skills were thus far deplorable. "I will mend them," Ailsa said slyly, taking the clothing from me and making eyes at Jocelyn. "There is virtue in a kindness dealt to strangers." Jocelyn blinked helplessly at me, drawing his knees up further in the bathing tub to hide his privates. "Serves you right," I said to him in d'Angeline, then in Skaldic to our putative mistress of the Steading. "Hatefick, I would see him groomed, if you would loan me your comb." She eyed him doubtfully. "See that he is soaped and dunked once more," she said. "I'm not minded to share fleas with Gunther's dogs. 'Tis hard enough to contend with them as it is." For all that, she brought the comb and had the grace to order the others out of the bathing room so Jocelyn could dress in peace. I combed his hair then, taking pains to ease through the mats and snarls. It was strangely soothing, putting me in mind of my childhood at Sirius House. Properly washed and combed,
Jocelyn's hair fell, blonde and shining, halfway down his back. I didn't try to bother with the castellan club, but twined it in one thick braid, binding it with thong. He endured the process with patience, for it was the closest thing to luxury either of us had known in a long time. "There," I said, unconsciously falling back into D'Angeline. "Let them see you now." He made a face but went out from the bathing room. If the women had stared before, now they gaped. I could understand why. Clean and groomed, he shone like a candle in the rude timbered interior of the great hall. Seeing him among the scaldy women, I thought it was no wonder Gunter's thanes made of me what they did, if I looked so to them. Having nigh emptied them with his bath, it was Jocelyn's job to refill the house cisterns. He did it with quiet grace, making trek after trek with the yoked buckets across his shoulders, stamping the snow from his boots before he entered the hall. Ailsa, sewing in a corner, watched him and smiled. If Gunter had not noticed before, he noticed it that night. He remarked on it to me as we lay in bed afterward. It had surprised me that he liked to talk after pleasure, when he'd not drunk heavily before it.
"He is pleasing to the women, your D'Angeline," he mused. "What do they see so in a beardless boy?"
So that was why he thought Jocelyn a boy still. "We do not grow hair like the Scaldi," I said to him. "Some of the old lines, where the blood of Elawa and his companions runs strong, grow none on their face. Jocelyn is a man grown. Perhaps women are less easily misled than men in this," I added, smiling. But Gunter was in no mood to be teased.
"Does Hedvig find him pleasing?" he asked me, yellow brows scowling in thought.
"She finds him pleasing to behold," I said honestly, "but she does not make eyes at him, as does Ailsa, my lord."
"Ailsa is a trial," he muttered. "Tell me, is the D'Angeline trained as you are? Kilbahar's men did not say so."
I nearly laughed, but smothered it as he was minded to take it wrong. "No, my lord," I said instead. "He is sworn to lie with no woman. It is part of his oath."
At that his brows shot up. "Truly?"
"Yes, my lord. It is true that he is a lord's son, but he is a priest first. A kind of priest as you know it. That is the nature of his oath."
"So he is not trained to please women, as you are to please men," Gunter said thoughtfully.
"No, my lord. Jocelyn is trained to be a warrior and companion, as I was trained to please in bed," I said, adding, "men and women both."
"Women?" his voice rumbled with surprise. "Where is the sense in that?"
"If my lord has to ask," I said, somewhat offended, "there is no merit in answering." I thought perhaps I had annoyed him then, and he would turn over and speak no more that evening. But Gunter was considering something. He lay gazing at the ceiling, running one finger beneath the cord of Melisande's diamond.
"I please you," he said eventually. "But you say it is a gift of your patron god."
"A gift, or betimes a curse," I muttered.
"All the gifts of the gods are like that," he said dismissively, pinning me with his shrewd look. "But I thought maybe you only said it that I would let you see the D'Angeline boy, eh?"
It was hard sometimes to remember that he was a clever man for all his scaldy ways. I shook my head. "What I said was true, my lord." It wasn't, of course, exactly true. I'd no idea if Kushiel's dart could be unstricken. But of a surety, it was true that I was its victim.
"So you say that I would not be pleasing to a D'Angeline woman who lacked your curse of a gift?"
"I am the only one with this gift," I murmured. "Does my lord wish me to answer him truly?"
"Yes," he said bluntly.
I remembered what Cecily had said about Childeric de Somme. "My lord makes love as if he is hunting boar," I said. It was not as much of an insult to a Skaldi as it would be to a Donjalin. It is a heroic act, but not necessarily pleasing to women. Gunter thought about this, absently smoothing his moustaches.
You could teach me, he said cannily, if you are trained, as you say.
I nearly laughed at that too, albeit bitterly.
I would be dead now were I not pleasing to Melisande Charizai, whose skills I would match against any adept of the Night Court.
Yes, my lord, I said, if it is your wish.
It would be a mighty thing to know.
He still had that canny look on his face, though in this he wasn't nearly as shrewd as he thought. I knew well enough that Hatevik had refused him 3 times. If he meant to give me to Voldemar Selig at the Althing, surely he would ask her a 4th. After his time with me, I did not think Gunter Arnlaugsen would be one to welcome a cold bed for long.
It is a dangerous thing to know, I said without thinking. But Gunter's mood had turned, and he laughed uproariously at my words.
You will begin to teach me this tomorrow, eh?
He said, adding cheerfully,
And if you speak of it, little dove, I will send your friend back to the kennels.
Matters resolved to his own satisfaction, Gunter rolled over and was soon snoring. I lay awake, rolling my eyes at the prospect, and prayed to Narmer for aid and guidance. It would be, I thought, a formidable task. So began my second tutorship among the Skaldi, and I dare say it went well enough, at least as the Skaldi would measure such things. I never heard afterward that Gunter had any complaints. It brought to light, though, a deeper danger. If the greatest danger one faces as a slave is displeasing one's masters, this is the second. Pleasing them. All too soon it becomes all too easy to forget doing aught else. Skaldi reckon time differently than we do. But the meeting of the tribes they named the Althing was still some weeks away. And once we had found our feet, Jocelyn and I, on solid ground at Gunter's steading, we began sliding into the trap of growing too comfortable in our roles. Wearing the mask of obedience so long, I saw Jocelyn forget at times that it was but a mask. And, for my part, to my dismay, I found myself falling asleep at times, thinking with pride, and even pleasure, upon Gunter's progress at our private lessons. Until the next time they raided. The shock of it was like ice-cold water. Gunter and his thanes arose in the small hours of the morning, rousing the entire household to service as they armed themselves for the raid, laughing and jesting and testing the edges of their weapons. They wore little in the way of armor, but wrapped themselves well in furs, and each man carried a shield as well as a sword or axe, and the short spear they favored. The horses were brought round, stamping and blowing frost under the faint stars. They would ride through the waning hours of the night, bursting through the pass at dawn to descend upon a hapless village in full daylight. Amid the clangor and bustle, Jocelyn and I stared at each other, pale with horror. I saw him begin to shake all over with repressed rage and turn away to hide his face from Gunter and his thanes. He made himself wisely scarce, and I did not see him until Gunter came striding, sheathing his sword, to bid me farewell, shouting as he came.
I ride into battle, little dove. Kiss me and pray to see me alive come nightfall.
I believe, in truth, that he had forgotten for the moment who I was and where I came from. I had not, and froze. And then Jocelyn was between us, brushing Gunter's reaching hands aside with a sweep of his forearms, effortless as thought. His blue eyes locked with Gunter's.
My lord, he said softly, allow her 1 ounce of pride.
What passed between them, I do not know. But Gunter's eyes narrowed, gauging the measure of Jocelyn's rebellion, while the castellan kept his face calm. After a moment, Gunter nodded.
We ride, he shouted, turning and beckoning to his thanes.
They streamed out of the great hall, brawn and fur and iron, mounted and rode, while those left behind cheered them on. Jocelyn sank to his knees and gave me a sick look. I just stood, gazing out through the open doors of the hall, and wept. They came back after nightfall. They came back victorious, boisterous and half-drunk and singing, staggering under the spoils they'd taken, meager enough stuff, sacks of grain and stores of winter roots and fruit. I heard Harold boasting about the number of dangelines he had slain. When I caught his eye, he fell silent, blushing. But he was one among many. Piecing the story together, I gathered that they had met with a party of warriors, allies of Cumlach, riding under the sign of the Flaming Sword. There had been a second banner, someone said, with a red forge on brown. Not Deglamore's men, then, I thought. Two thanes had fallen, Turville among them, but they had won the day, slaying half the dangelines before retreating through the skirling snows. If Gunter had been mindful of my sensibilities upon leaving, he took no such niceties upon his victorious return, and I had had the wit to caution Jocelyn not to intervene. Thanks to Elowa, he did not, for I think Gunter in a drunken state might have set upon him. When the celebration had reached its apex, and besotten warriors sprawled about the hall, Gunter hoisted me over his shoulder, amid roars of approval, carrying me away. It was not a night for lessons. When he was done, I left him snoring and crept from his bed into the great hall, where his thanes slept off their mead, rumbling and murmuring. Someone had remembered to secure Jocelyn's leg irons. I thought he too slept, there by the hearth bench, but his eyes opened at my near soundless approach. "I couldn't stay there," I whispered. "I know." He moved over, cautious not to clank his irons, and made room for me on the rushes. It was one of his duties to see that they were replaced when the hall was swept. I sank down to the floor and curled up next to him. His arm came around me, and I laid my head on his chest and stared into the dying embers of the fire. "Jocelyn, you have to leave," I murmured.
"I can't."
Low as it was, I could hear the agony in his voice.
"I can't leave you here."
"Damn your Carseel to hell, then," I hissed, eyes stinging. His chest rose and fell beneath my cheek.
"He believed he was, you know,"
Jocelyn said in a low voice. He touched my hair lightly with one hand, stroking it.
"I learned it all my life, but I never truly understood it until now."
A shudder ran through me. "I know," I whispered, thinking of Nama, who had lain with strangers, who had lain with the King of Persis, thinking of Voldemar Selig, the Skaldi war leader. "I know." We did not speak then for a long time. I had nearly fallen asleep when I heard Jocelyn ask softly,
"How can Deglamore bear it? He is sending dangelines to die against the Skaldi."
10 may die, and 100 more rally to his banner," I said, staring into the embers. "And he can blame the king for Cumlach's losses, for not sending him further troops. That was his plan with the Glory Seekers. He is building an empire. How he can do it, I don't understand, but I can see the why of it. What I would like to know is why does Gunter have no fear of him?"
"Because Deglamore pays him," Jocelyn said bitterly.
"No," I shook my head against his chest. "It's more than that. Gunter knows something that Deglamore doesn't." He laughed when I told him there were things Kilbehar didn't know. "Gonzago de Escabares said it a year ago. The Skaldi have found a leader who thinks."
"Elowa, help us all," Jocelyn whispered.
After that, neither of us spoke, and then I did sleep, and wakened only to a light tug on my sleeve. Opening my eyes, I met the worried features of Turid, the shy one, who had risen early to her chores. Dim light filtered into the great hall from the oiled skins over the windows,
and slumbering thanes still snored around us, stinking of stale mead.
"You must go," she whispered to me. "They will wake soon."
It was the first moment, I think, that I realized how things had begun to change between Jocelyn and me. In the shock and horror of the night, it had only seemed natural that we held to each other for comfort. The faint awe on Turret's face made something different of it. I sat up, brushing away bits of rush tangled in my hair and caught in my skirts. Jocelyn's eyes were open, watching me. What he thought, I could not say. Neither of us dared speak now, for fear of rousing the thanes. I squeezed his hand once and rose, stealing after Turid, who picked her way carefully among the snoring warriors, to slip back into Gunter's room and between the warm furs of his bed. He made a rumbling noise in his sleep and turned over, drawing me into his embrace. I lay wide-eyed in the curve of his massive arm, despising him.
Chapter 44. After the raid, matters settled back into familiar routine, though neither Jocelyn nor I were likely to succumb to its comforts any time soon. The raid had served its purpose as a bitter reminder of the reality of our situation. Winter in the city of Elawar is not a pleasant time. It grows chill, and betimes a sweeping wind blows that drives everyone indoors and halts trade and leisure alike. But it is nothing to life on a Scaldy steading. Here we were truly snowbound, for at times the weather grew so fierce not even the Scaldy would venture out for any length of time. And even when it was fair, there was nowhere to go, and precious little to do. In some ways, I think, the tedium was easier on the women and carles, for even in winter there was work to be done. But when they could not hunt, Gunter and his thanes were oft condemned to idleness. If the Scaldi are overly fond of wagering, bickering, and drinking among themselves, I learned why. When the men are winter-bound in the confines of the Great Hall, there is naught else to be done. They have their poetry, of course, and of that there was an abundance. In addition to the Scaldi war songs I knew, and those homelier tales I learned from the women, I heard endless heroic sagas, humorous stories, epic lays, that related tales of warring gods and giants, and a new growing body of verse, the rise of Voldemar Selig. Of him many wondrous things were told. It was said that when his mother died in childbirth, a she-wolf was heard scratching at the door of the great hall in his steading, of which his father was the lord. When his thanes opened the door, they saw the wolf, and none dared harm her, for her fur was as white as snow, and they knew her for a supernatural creature. She padded through the hall and straight to the infant Voldemar, lying beside him, and he reached for her fearlessly, taking hold of her white fur with his chubby fists and nursing. They said that when he was still a lad, though half a head taller than any man in the steading, and fully as broad, his father gave him a handful of gold and bid him to see the land. Thus did Voldemar travel disguised, with only two loyal thanes to accompany him. To all who gave him hospitality he revealed himself and paid them in gold. Those who shunned him he challenged and defeated every one, revealing himself only after the victory. So did his name and his fame spread across the far-flung Scaldic territories, and he came to be spoken of in terms of awe. He freed an owl caught up in a trapper's lines, who turned into a wizard, and gave him a charm that would blunt the edges of his enemy's weapons, so they would deal him no wound. He met a witch, they said, whose son was of giant blood. Him he slew by discovering that his life was held in an old root ball the witch kept in her cupboard, which Voldemar threw upon the fire. He threatened to slay the witch as well, but she begged for her life and gave him a charm to make him proof against poison. When he came home at last to his own steading, he found his father slain, and the most powerful of his thanes, Lothnir, had wed his sister and laid claim to the steading and the leadership of the tribe. Lothnir met him with an embrace and offered him a poisoned cup in welcome. Voldemar drank it down and threw the cup upon the snow, where it hissed and gave forth fumes, but he was unharmed. Then Lothnir came upon him at night while he slept, and struck at him with a dagger. But the edges of the blade turned dull and slid from his skin as if from a stiff-cured hide, and Voldemar only sighed in his sleep. In the morning he challenged Lothnir and slew him with one cast of his spear, so mighty it split his shield and pierced his heart. He was acclaimed as leader and gave his sister to one of his steadfast companions to wife. These were the tales of Voldemar Selig, and if I was not naive enough to believe them the literal truth, indeed I recognized in some the echoes of ancient Hellene tales. The glee with which the Skaldi heard and told them made me uneasy. Of a surety, they reckoned this man a hero, and not, from what I knew, without reason. If no other part of these stories was true, one thing was. He had united the contentious Skaldi tribes in their admiration of him. Soon enough, though, a new dispute rose out of the cloistered life we led, providing Vestedding with a new distraction from the tedium of winter. And this dispute, unfortunately, had Jocelyn at its centre. The young Skaldi woman Ailsa persisted in her interest in him. True to her word, she had washed and mended his castline garb, presenting it to him with an insinuating smile. Jocelyn blushed and smiled, there being naught else as a slave he could do. When he did not don it, but continued to wear the woolens given him by Turid, Ailsa pouted and flounced about the hall, flaunting her displeasure until he put it on to quiet her. I know Hatefic had a sharp word with the young woman, reminding her that Jocelyn was a slave and Gunter's property. Ailsa, however, was clever enough in her own right, and pointed out that as a Dungeline lord's son, and it had been Gunter himself who'd put about word that Jocelyn was a warrior prince, he was as much a hostage as a slave, and therefore of a worthy status. Gunter kept a wary eye on these proceedings, and had no great trust of Ailsa, but the prospect of a ransom intrigued him. When he asked Jocelyn if his father would pay money for his safe return, Jocelyn, all unwitting, promptly answered that he was sure he would, as would the prefect of the Castline Brotherhood, although, he added, not unless I accompanied him. The matter gave Gunter somewhat to mull over, and Ailsa no reason to desist in her pursuit. I had little hope of the prospect of ransom coming to fruition. Fierce though they were, Gunter and his thanes weren't likely to succeed in fighting their way across the whole of Cumlach to deliver the message, and Deglamour was hardly like to carry it for him, but it sufficed to give me concern. For the other point in this triangle of dispute was one Evrar, the sharp-tongued, a surly thane who'd come honestly by his nickname and harboured a jealous fondness for Ailsa. It did not help that she was a terrible flirt, reckoning herself the belle of the steading, and it did not help that Evrar was a homely man, albeit a wealthy one. Evrar's persecution of Jocelyn was blatant. Echoing Ailsa's own unsubtle techniques, the thane made a point of putting himself in the Castellan's path. But instead of a flounce or an incidental brush, he dealt in trips, shoves, and taunts. Time and again, Jocelyn attempted to step out of his way, only to find himself mocked or sent sprawling. It got so bad that he could not even go to spread new rushes on a clean-swept patch of floor without finding Evrar's boot-heels propped on the spot, while the thane cursed and swatted at him for the inconvenience. If Jocelyn had given no reason for Gunter and his thanes to mistrust him, he had not incited their love, either. His effect upon the women at the steading had provoked too much resentment for that, and when they saw the white lines of silent fury etched on his face, they remembered his early days and taunted him further, hoping to kindle him to wild rebellion for their sport. Eventually they succeeded. It fell on an evening of blizzard, when everyone was confined to the hall, and Jocelyn came in shivering from the outdoors with an armload of wood for the cook-stove. Catching his eye, Ailsa blew him a kiss and made an unsubtle gesture, hoisting her becurtled breasts at him to show off her considerable cleavage. Blushing and distracted, he had not wholly lost his castling prurience. Jocelyn failed to see when Evra thrust a booted foot in his path and tripped over it accordingly, measuring his length on the floor of the great hall, scattering kindling as he fell. Even that he endured. I was playing the lute quietly at the time, and saw him kneel, head bowed, gathering up the fallen wood. Gunter sat in his chair by the fire, watching idly.
"Look at that,"
Evra said contemptuously, flicking Jocelyn's braid with one brawny hand.
"What man has such hair, and none upon his chin? What man blushes like a maid, and takes no offence at being treated like a carl? No man, I say, but a woman."
It drew a laugh from the thanes, although I saw Hatevik's lips thin from across the room. Jocelyn's shoulders stiffened, though he continued to ignore the thane.
"He's pretty enough for one, eh?"
Evra continued.
"Maybe we ought to check."
Everyone has their own particular genius. Evra the sharp-tongued was for goading others, and he saw from Jocelyn's tense stillness that he'd landed a bolt that stung.
"What do you say?"
he asked two of his comrades, bluff and boisterous.
"Give me a hand there, and we'll skin this wolf-cub of his drabs. See if he's a bitch after all, shall we?"
I stopped playing and looked at Gunter, hoping he would stop it. Alas, he was bored enough to see it as good sport. So it was that Evra the sharp-tongued and the handful of thanes set upon Jocelyn, intent on wrestling him to the ground and stripping off his clothing. Of their intent, I've no doubt. How it played out was another matter. The moment the first hand closed on his shoulder, Jocelyn was on his feet, a stout length of branch in each hand. It was the first time, I believe, they had occasion to witness him fight in the castling style of combat. The edge of Jocelyn's skill had not dulled. If anything, the weeks of hard labour and smothered rage had honed it. He fought with calm, deadly efficiency, the impromptu staves moving in a blur, whirling and warding. Within moments the rest of the hall was in an uproar, thanes rushing into the fray and staggering back out, clutching bruised limbs and battered skulls. I understand some little about the two-handed castling fighting style. It is designed to afford the most protection to one's ward, making an armed human shield of the wielder. With no companion to protect, Jocelyn grimly protected himself, holding nearly the entire fighting force of Gunter's steading at bay for a goodly amount of time. For his part, Gunter watched it with the same interest he'd shown when they first captured Jocelyn. It took some 7 or 8 men to bring him down at last, muscling with brute force past the reach of his staves and bearing him to the floor, where he continued to thrash as they roared with laughter and tugged at his clothing. I had drawn breath to shout, though my mind was empty of words, when Gunter did it himself, raising his voice to a bellow of command.
"Enough!" he shouted.
He had mighty lungs. I could swear the very rafters trembled. His thanes grew still and allowed Jocelyn to rise. He gained his feet, dishevelled, his clothing askew, fair shivering with rage. But to his credit, he stood his ground, crossing his arms and bowing stiffly in Gunter's direction. If anything, it was that which saved him. Gunter took on his canny look, drumming thick fingers on the arm of his chair and looking thoughtfully at the infuriated Evra.
"So you claim injury of this man, eh, sharp tongue?"
"Gunter," Evra said with bitter eagerness, quick to take the bait,
"this carl, this slave of yours, has made the cuckoo's nest of this steading. Look," he said, pointing an accusatory finger at Ailsa, "look how he woos the very women from under our noses into his servile embrace."
"If there is wooing being done," Hatevik called,
casting a direful glance at Ailsa, who sniffed,
"look to yon vixen, Gunter Arnlaugsen."
It got a greater laugh than Evra had done.
Gunter rested his chin in one hand and gazed at Jocelyn.
What do you say of it, Dangeline?
If Jocelyn had learned anything in Gunter's steading, he had learned somewhat of how the Scaldi measure such things, and the vocabulary with which they speak of them. He tugged his garments into order and met Gunter's gaze evenly.
My lord, he questions my manhood. I beg your leave to answer him with steel. Well, well,
Gunter's yellow brows rose.
So we've not drawn the wolf cub's teeth, eh? Well, sharp tongue, I nearly think he's challenged you to the home gang. What do you say to that?
I knew not this word, but Evrar paled at it.
Gunter, he's a housecarl at best. You cannot ask me to fight a slave. I will not stand for the shame of it. Maybe he is a carl, and maybe he is not,
Gunter said ambiguously.
Voldemar Selig was taken hostage by the Vandali, and he fought their champions one by one, until they made him their leader. Do you say Voldemar Selig was a carl?
Voldemar Selig was no Dangeline fop, Evrar hissed.
Do you mean to make a mockery of me? Oh, I think no man will mock you for fighting this wolf cub in the home gang,
Gunter laughed, glancing around the hall.
What do you say,
Rubbing their bruised parts, the thanes met his query with dour glares. No, I thought, none of them would make mock of the challenge. Gunter grinned, slamming his fist down on the arm of his chair.
So be it then, he announced. Tomorrow we have the home gang.
If they did not favour Jocelyn, there was no great fondness for Evrar the sharp-tongued either. Young Harold shouted his approval and cried out the first wager, putting good silver coin on the Dangeline wolf cub. It was promptly taken by one of Evrar's backers, and in the general uproar the matter was approved. With quiet dignity, Jocelyn gathered up his armload of kindling and continued into the kitchen. The following day dawned clear and fair, and the thanes, grateful for sport, made a holiday of it. I'd no idea still what they were about. With great ceremony, a vast hide was brought forth, and a square field trampled flat in the snow. The hide was pinned flat with broad-headed pins, and four hazel rods set out from the corners, marking an aisle around the hide. For all that Evrar was not well loved, he was Scaldi, and the bulk of the thanes supported him, crowded round him, testing the edge of his blade and offering advice and extra shields alike. Jocelyn watched the preparations with perplexity, at last approaching Gunter and asking respectfully,
"My lord, may I ask the manner of this fighting?" "What? You the challenger and not knowing?"
Gunter teased him and laughed at his own jest.
"It is the home gang, wolf cub. One sword to each man, and three shields, if you can find those who will lend them. The first to shed the other's blood upon the hide is the victor, and he who sets both feet onto the hazeled field is reckoned to flee, and forfeits the victory."
Good-naturedly he unslung his own sword.
"You defended your honour well, Dangeline, and for that I give you loan of my second-best blade. But for a shield, you must go begging."
Jocelyn took the hilt in his hand and stared at it, then raised his gaze to Gunter's.
"My lord, my oath forbids me," he said, shaking his head and offering it back, laying the blade across his arm and proffering the hilt. "I am bound to draw my sword only to kill. Give me my daggers and my..." There was no word for vambrace in Scaldic. "My arm shields, and I will fight this man."
"It is the home gang,"
Gunter clapped him cheerfully on the shoulder.
"You should kill him if you can, wolf cub, or he will surely challenge you again tomorrow or the next day. Anyway, I have a bet on you."
He wandered off then, shouting at one of the thanes who had mismeasured the placement of a hazel rod. I stood shivering under my fur cloak, while Jocelyn stared back down at the sword in his hand. He'd not held a blade since we were captured. He looked helplessly up at me. "'He would take your life, Carceline,' I said to him in Dangeline, struggling to keep my teeth from chattering, "'and leave me unprotected. But I cannot tell you what to choose.' Knut, my kind and homely guard, sidled up to us.
"'Here,' he said gruffly, thrusting his own shield at Jocelyn. "'Take this, boy. There's no honour in forcing a slave to fight unguarded.'
"'Thank you,' Jocelyn said to him, bowing awkwardly with sword and shield. Knut nodded brusquely, moving away from him and whistling as though he'd naught to do with it. Jocelyn settled the shield in his left hand and hoisted the sword, testing its balance, eyeing it with a kind of awe. On the far side of the hide, Evrar essayed a few darting jabs and doughty strokes with his own sword to shouts of laughter and encouragement. Sharp-tongued he might be, but he was a scaldy warrior in the prime of life and a veteran of a dozen raids. It would be no easy match. His second stood by with a replacement shield, and another close at hand.
"'Any last bets, eh?'
Gunter shouted, having satisfied himself regarding the pinning of the hide and the placement of the hazel rods.
"'We are ready, then. Let the home gang begin, and he who is challenged may strike the first blow.'
Grinning through clenched teeth, Evrar stepped onto the hide and scraped his feet against it, testing the surface. Jocelyn stepped soberly up to meet him. The women of the steading had gathered to watch, and no few of them sighed at the sight of him.
"'Take his pretty head off, Shoptongue!' one of the thanes yelled.
Others laughed.
"'He has the first blow,'
Gunter cautioned Jocelyn, who nodded, bracing his shield. I remember well how the sky overhead was the deep, brilliant blue that the scaldy sky turns on clear winter days, the ground beneath it eye-blindingly white with snow. Evrar warmed to his attack with a prolonged roar, a rumble that began in the depths of his chest and gathered momentum as he swung his blade, issuing from his mouth in a powerful bellow as he rushed forward. All around, fur-clad Scaldy shouted and gasped. I think Jocelyn and I were the only two silent. Jocelyn raised Knut's shield. It took the blow, but shattered beneath it, leaving worthless bits of painted wood. He cast the broken shield aside, as Evrar, still bellowing, made ready to launch a second blow. I had never seen the Carceline fight with a sword, save in his practice bouts with Alcuin. He held the hilt in a two-handed grip, slanted across his body, and moved like a dancer. The blade of Gunter's sword whirled, and Evrar's blow was parried. Jocelyn spun lightly into the backstroke, and Evrar's shield broke beneath it.
"'Shield!' Evrar shouted, scrambling backward. "'Shield!'
Jocelyn allowed him to take his second shield, settling it on his arm, waiting with the hilt of his sword at shoulder level now, the blade still angled toward his body. The Carceline Brotherhood is, at its most basic level, an elite bodyguard. They are trained to work in tight situations, not battlefields, and do not bear shields. That is why they wear the vambraces. If Jocelyn lacked his, he did not need them that day. He fainted once, moved smoothly away from a wild swing of Evrar's, and thrust forward. This time Evrar's shield struck on the point of his sword. He dislodged it swiftly, yanking it from the Scaldy's grasp, and snapped the cracked wood in two with one quick stamp of his foot.
"'Shield!'
Evrar whispered, groping blindly. I do not know what Jocelyn was thinking, but I saw his face as he swung, and it was empty of everything but a calm, at once serene and blazing. He turned beneath that bright sky, moved his head only slightly to avoid Evrar's blow, and the two-handed stroke he dealt held all of his momentum. The blade flashed like a star, crashing through the third and final shield, and splinters flew like rain.
"No,"
Evrar's voice trembled. He put up one hand and took a step backward off the hide, setting one foot in the hazel rod aisle. I might have pitied him, were it not for the thought of Dangeline's dying under his spear.
"'Please!'
Jocelyn held the raised sword blade angled high, and sunlight glinted off it to cast an edge of brightness across his face.
"I will not be forsworn, Skaldi," he said softly, taking care with the words in a strange tongue. "Step off the hide, or die."
If it had only been the two of them, I think Evrar the sharp-tongued would have retreated. But he was among Skaldi, warriors with whom he'd ridden cheek to jowl, and all were watching, and not only them, but the women. If he feared to lose face by fighting a slave, how much more did he stand to lose by running from one? I did not like the man, but I will say this for him. He met his death bravely. Forced to choose between the watching Skaldi and the waiting Castellan, Evrar summoned his courage and loosed it in a final roar, charging, swinging his sword like a berserker. Jocelyn parried the blow, pivoting, following through on his own swing, the edge of his blade catching Evrar full across the midriff, angling upward. It was a death blow and no mistake. Evrar crumpled to the hide and lay on moving, a pool of blood spreading slowly beneath him. For a moment there was silence. Then Gunter pumped one fist skyward and shouted his approval, and his thanes echoed it. It had been a fair fight and a good one by their standards. Jocelyn stood watching blood seep from Evrar's corpse, his face pale. I remembered then that he had never killed a man before, and I liked him better for taking it hard. He knelt then, laying down his sword and folding his arms, murmuring a Castellan prayer beneath his breath. When he was done, he rose and cleaned his blade, walking over to present it hilt first to Gunter, who took it back with a shrewd look.
"Thank you, my lord, for allowing me to defend my honour,"
Jocelyn said carefully and bowed.
"I am sorry for the death of your thane." "Sharp tongue brought it on himself, eh?"
Gunter said cannily, putting a meaty arm about Jocelyn's shoulders and giving him a shake.
"I tell you, wolf cub, how is it if you take his place?"
"My lord?" Jocelyn shot him an incredulous look. Gunter grinned.
"I'm minded to take a risk on you, Dangeline. They seem to pay off, If I give you your irons back, does your oath still bind you? Are you still minded to protect and serve my life with your own, if need be?"
Jocelyn swallowed hard. It would be harder, a harder chore and temptation than he'd been given before. He met my eye, and resolve hardened his features.
"I have sworn it," he said. "Do you keep my Lady Phaedra no de Launay safe?" "Good."
Gunter gave his shoulders another squeeze and shake.
"Give him a cheer, eh?" he cried to his thanes. "The boy has proved himself a man this day."
They cheered then and came around, clapping him on the back and boasting or bemoaning the bets they'd laid on the home gang, while Evrar lay dead and cooling nearby. Someone began to pass around a skin of mead, and the singing began, one of the wits beginning to make a story of it. The epic battle of Evrar the Sharp-Tongued and Vedangeline's slave boy. I watched a while longer, still shivering, then went inside with Hatevik and the women to prepare for the boisterous carousing to follow. Whether things had just gotten better or worse, I could not have said. Chapter 45. It was passing strange to see Jocelyn attendant on Gunter in full Castellan regalia. His mended grey garments, the vambraces on his forearms, daggers at his belt, and sword at his back. Allowed a measure of freedom, he resumed the practice of his morning exercises, flowing through the intricate series of movements that formed the basis of the Brotherhood's fighting style. The Skaldi beheld this oddity with a mix of awe and scorn. Their own combat skills were straightforward and efficient, reliant on might of arms, sheer ferocity, and the fact that most Skaldi warriors are taught to wield a blade from the time they can lift one. Their attitude toward Jocelyn's discipline was consistent with their feelings toward Terdange as a whole, and I will admit,
It is something I never quite fathomed. It was a strange commingling of derision and yearning, contempt and envy, and I mused upon these things while the steading began to prepare for its journey to the All-Thing, for my survival depended largely on my ability to comprehend the Skaldi nature. Would that I'd had a map in those days to mark our place in the steading, and the meeting place decreed by Voldemar Selig. Delaunay had taught me to read maps, of course, and I dare say I could do so as well as any general, but I had no skill to chart my way by the stars, as navigators do. I knew only that we were close to one of the great passes through the Carmeline Range, and that we would ride east to the All-Thing. 7 days' ride, Gunter said, or perhaps 8. That I would accompany them, he took as a matter of course, although he had still said nothing to me of being a gift for Voldemar Selig. 20 thanes would go with him to represent the steading, and Hedvig and 3 others to speak for the women. They had not the say of the men, but there was an old tale. There is always an old tale among Wiscaldi, of how Brunhild Bedouti wrestled Hobart Longspear, and took him 2 falls out of 3, to win the right for women to speak at the All-Thing. I suspected Gunter was minded to travel without them, but even he was wary of Hedvig's wrath. I do not know if she wrestled, but of a surety she wielded a mean ladle, and had no compunctions about raising knots on the skull of any man to oppose her. As for Jocelyn, it was simply assumed that he, too, would make the journey, as Gunter's body-servant. Gunter Arnlaugsson had a fondness for the trappings of power, and it made him strut not a little to have the castling attendant, with his deft bow and dangeline elegance. So we made ready to go, and I had my first taste of Skaldic augury. An old man, the priest of Odin, was fetched to the great hall, and led the steading in procession to a stand of winter barren oak, their sacred grove. He spread a cloak of stainless white wool upon the snow, and mumbled over bits of rune-carved rods, casting them upon the garment. 3 times he did this, then proclaimed in a loud voice that the omens were favourable. Gunter's thanes cheered at the announcement, banging their short spears on their shields. I, shivering as always in the Skaldic cold, prayed silently to Blessed Eloa for protection, and to Nama and Kushiel, whose sign I bore. A raven lighted near me on one of the leafless branches, ruffling its feathers and cocking 1 round black eye at me. At first it gave me fear. Then I remembered that when Eloa wandered through the Skaldic hinterlands, the ravens and wolves were his friends, and it heartened me somewhat. A full spring thaw had broken the ice upon the stream, and we would take our leave in the morning. Much of the remaining day was spent in final preparations, in which I had little part, save to watch the bustle and bundle of it all. Gunter, a seasoned campaigner, had the prudence to retire early, taking me with him. I thought he would leave me be that night, to be all the fresher in the morning, but he tumbled me instead with a soldier's vigorous efficiency, spending himself with a heroic shout and rolling off me to snore within minutes. I'd taught him better than that, of course, but he had determined in his naively crafty way that it didn't matter with a slave when he was minded to have his simple pleasures. And of a surety, it mattered naught with me, dart-stricken and cursed. I lay awake in the darkness, throbbing with the aftermath of a pleasure I despised, and wondered what the coming fortnight would bring. We arose with the dawn and made ready to leave. He came beaming into the bedroom with a bundle of woolen undergarments and fur wrappings, a gift for me against the cold. To my surprise, he even knelt to wrap the leggings on himself, showing me how to lace the leather thongs to keep them secure. When he was done, he did not rise immediately, but lifted my skirts and thrust his head beneath them, parting my thighs to bestow a kiss upon my pearl of Nama, as I had taught him. "I will not ever forget you," he said gruffly, smoothing my skirts in place and looking upward. "Maybe your gods have cursed you, but Gunter Arnlaugsson counts it a blessing, eh?" The last thing I ever expected of him was tenderness. But lest it undo me, Melisande's diamond glinted at his throat, reminding me of things I had rather forget. I put my hands on his head and kissed him, thanking him for the gift of clothing. It seemed it was enough. He rose, pleased, and went about his business, seeing to the equipage of the horses. Well, that is that, I thought. He means to do it. The journey to the old thing took a full 8 days, and if it was not the hardest thing I have ever endured, I thought it was at the time. I had a horse of my own to ride, for Gunther was mindful of our mounts, and I spent interminable hours hunched in the saddle in my woolens and furs, the reins slack, trusting to my sturdy mount to follow the others. A cold snap followed the full spring, and the snow, softened by warmth, hardened with a brittle crust that made riding slow and bit at the horses' legs. When we made camp at night, the Scaldi tended their mounts first, rubbing their legs down with a salve made of bear grease. Our camp was made with rude tents of cured hide, but afforded some protection against the cold. Although he made no move to touch me, Gunther kept me with him, and I am not ashamed to say that I huddled against him at night for warmth. We survived on a fare of pottage and dried strips of meat, of which I grew heartily tired. The lands through which we rode were splendid, though I was hardly minded to appreciate them. The Scaldi seemed not to mind the cold as I did, singing as they rode, breath frosty on the chill air. Hatefix's cheeks were rosy with cold,